Okay, we do want to take a few minutes for questions, and we will ask that you use the mic, not because the room's so big, but...
Again, there we go. That sounds like that's fun. But again, so we capture sometimes the richest part of the evening is some of the Q and A. So we do want to capture that on the CD as well. So anyone want to start us off?
I was intrigued by your information about the increase in delinquency among girls starting in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Family bonding seemed to be... That was contemporaneous to our welfare reform effort, where we started requiring parents on welfare to get out of the home and to go get jobs and to stop hanging around and taking care of your kids, turn them over to a daycare center and get a job.
I don't think it was a good thing. I mean, they should have. I would have started saying, you can keep your kids and we will train you to be good. We will train you to be a good parent, but you have to go through these evidence-based programs and prove that you are an effective parent, and we'll pay you to stay home with your kids. I mean, there should have been ways to work that out. Because, I mean, it's clear that daycare facilities are not good. They're not necessarily, you know, starting kids off really early in some of these daycare centers that the poor families can afford are not really giving them what they need.
We actually have a program in this state down in Las Cruces.
Mm-hmm. It's the best.
That works with welfare recipients, and the Human Services Department has allowed them to participate in the program rather than to go get a job.
Yeah.
That's a pretty sketchy version of it, but that's the way I understand it to work. And it seems to be working well.
I mean, we shouldn't devalue the job of parenting. I mean, parenting should be considered, as a valuable, professional, kind of skill and job. And I remember a Judge Gladstone in Miami, when we first started the OJJDP project, Find All the Best Parenting and Family Partners, and he said, the reason he wanted to be on the advisory committee is that he said, these kids, even if their parents are sent off to treatment or sent off to jail or sent off to prison, whatever, and they're sent off to foster care, they're running away to try and get back with their parents. Nobody matters to them as much as their real parent. And knowing that that real parent is a good person and loves them is the most important thing in the world.
Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that.
So happy to hear you say that. In that vein, I'm wondering if you did any research in terms of cost-benefit analysis about children who wind up at much higher levels in the delinquency system themselves, and ultimately, in terms of when you're costing out the cost of incarceration, there is some strong data, I believe, although I don't know how analysisable it is.
I'll take the mic here, Tim.
In terms of the number of children of incarcerated parents who wind up incarcerated themselves.
If I understand correctly, you're referring to the relationship between being a child of an incarcerated parent and the child's later involvement in delinquency. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a tricky subject, and I think Carol referred to it in her slide presentation. There are references in the professional literature to studies that link status as a child of an incarcerated parent with subsequent delinquency. And as part of my New York study, I assigned my research analyst the job of checking that literature out, following the trail. And that claim about a strong relationship between being a child of an incarcerated parent and later involvement in delinquency was repeated in a set of articles that led back into the early 90s, and we eventually got back to the original article, and there was no citation or study that founded it. So it was a claim that was made in one article, and there's no research, we never found the research to support it. And that gave us pause. From where I stand, it makes sense that there would be a relationship, And, you know, there was a recent review of this literature by a guy named Joseph Murray in the UK. I think he's at Cambridge. He's a protege of David Farrington, who's a noted criminologist. He did one of these massive reviews of the literature on the relationship between parental behavior and a child's involvement in delinquency. And there's a lot of stuff that is suggestive, where there are some statistical associations, but his final conclusion, after it was a 75-page paper, and like, you know, he really had to wade through it. Final conclusion was, it's not conclusive. And that's the best I can offer.
I'm so sorry to hear that, because
most of it is just very complex. I mean, almost as I've looked at it, you can't actually, just because somebody is an incarcerated parent, that their kid is going to be delinquent. What mattered most was not the category, but the quality of the parenting. Was that if you could go back and actually look at the quality of the parenting that was going on, that was what mattered in whether or not the kid ends up being delinquent. Of course, there's a ton of other factors, even the genetic factors that I was talking about. Certain genetic factors that predispose, at least we know, for alcohol and drug abuse, but I don't know about it. You know, there's been all kinds of wild claims about, you know, criminality and all that. And I don't think that there's that, but I think what you have is more this inability to control emotions, some certain neurotransmitter imbalances.
I would agree, but when we go into our D-homes, our youth delinquency places, and survey children, the number of them that are children of incarcerated parents or who have a significant parenting figure in their lives who are incarcerated is staggering.
As you're perhaps thinking of another question or two, I do want to point out that I think it's on the right-hand side at the very back, we have an evaluation form, and we'd really like you to fill it out to give us feedback not only on this seminar this evening, but also give us some ideas for future seminars.
And Dr. Archuleta, to go along with that, we still have some chocolate syrup and coffee.
There you go.
I'd be happy to pass it in if you'll promise to stay and fill out your evaluation.
I had another question for Dr. Lingell. That issue of when people are incarcerated, crimes in the neighborhood go down, but they're not, the crime, yeah. And yet, isn't there a certain amount of that crime that didn't take place because they had already hit the liquor store first, so now that they're out of the way, I can hit the liquor store, and so it doesn't necessarily, it's not a one-to-one kind of decrease, is it? I mean, it's just like only a certain number of times you can hit the liquor store or break into the house, and if the person breaking in isn't there, it opens up an opportunity for somebody else.
Well, you remember I referred to that study by Stephen Levitt, and I said I would explain that if somebody asked, and essentially what you've done is ask about that study. I mean, that study answers your question. On the one hand, you're alluding to an issue, there's an issue in the literature called replacement crime. So that issue is, if you arrest 10 drug dealers and put them in prison, aren't they just replaced by 10 other street entrepreneurs who come out and sell drugs? Okay, well, that's not clear. What Levitt did, that directly answers your question is, the guy is just, I mean, how he would think of this. So in the 1980s and 1990s, we had a lot of prison overcrowding. And there were a lot of lawsuits filed by prisoner advocacy organizations and civil rights type organizations about prison overcrowding. And there were lawsuits filed in at least 13 states where they said, you know, you can't hold people in these conditions. You know, like 2-3 to a cell that's 100 square feet, so on and so forth. And in 15 states, these prison overcrowding litigation cases resulted in consent decrees between the supervising court and the state. And the consent decrees, by and large, required the states to reduce their prison population. And so the different states developed formulae for selectively dumping prisoners back into the community. Okay, so Leavitt then got together the statistics on these 13 states, and he said, okay, now here we have a decrease in the prison population that's not related to crime, that is putting prisoners back on the street. Okay, and we know the number of prisoners it's putting back on the street in every state by year. So then why don't we look at the crime statistics in those states and ask if there's a change in the crime statistics from dumping, say, 10,000 prisoners back on the streets. Well, there was, and it was absolutely clear, and the average increase in crime per prisoner release was 14.7 crimes per year. So that suggests that you can hit the same liquor store again and again. And you can find
14 times.
Yeah, you can find other cars to break into. You know, and you can find other ways to engage in, I mean, you know, illegal activity, you know, knows no bounds. So that's the answer to that question. I think Leavitt's study pretty well addressed that.
Those street entrepreneurs would have been out there hitting the street even if that guy hadn't vacated that particular corner.
This is an interesting question. I've been reading an ethnography of crack dealers by a guy named Bruce Jacobs. And he was studying crack dealers in, where was it? Was it St. Louis? That's right. St. Louis in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And what he reported was that there was a lot of competition on the street corners. There was an excess of sellers because it was an easy way to make some quick bucks, although it was kind of boring because you ended up staying around a long time. But there were a lot of guys there. And what I think is that there's so many people who are, and a lot of the people were doing it part-time. You know, they would do it for 5 hours a week. And then there were a few who did it maybe 10 hours a week. Nobody did it full-time. It just seems to me that the model of entrepreneurship is there's kind of an overpopulation, oversupply of people who are willing to do it. I don't think the replacement model quite describes how street level drug dealing actually occurs. That's the nuance that I would give to it.
Something that really struck me as I was reading through a lot of the research and searching for these folks was the increase. Now, the field of corrections is not my field, although I had come to realize that it was on the rise, and especially here in New Mexico, we had new institutions popping up around the state, almost as economic development efforts in some counties once they get off. And there's a point of no return. For a little while, it provides jobs, and then there's a plateau, and it becomes a diminishing return. Once that institution's in place, it's to capacity, the hiring is finished. But one of the things that I ran into over and over and over as I read was this incline. And in the last 25 to 30 years, we have roughly quadrupled the folks that are in prison. And one statement said, there are a million more people incarcerated than there were last generation. One generation. And something like, Tom, you may need to help me, but something like 90% plus of that is attributed to drug offenses.
The war on drugs.
The war on drugs. Okay, there are some sort of static percentages. Yes, our population in general is larger than it was 20 years ago, and so there were going to be some more incarcerations, but there's sort of a static percentage of
folks there for burglaries and murders and those kinds of things. This huge, huge incline was strictly drug offenses. But that 1 million, just, I reread that to be sure that's what I was reading.
Okay, I think I'll end the formal question session. I'm sure our presenters would be glad to stick around a little bit longer if you'd like to visit. But also, I don't want to let the evening end without acknowledging some of our other NMSU folks, Esther Duvall, Lisa Shields, Nancy Bryan. They are out there. Trina, sorry. You're so close. I was missing you in my line of vision, but these folks are out there every day in the trenches doing some of the engineering things that we've heard about today. And Jane Orman is also an NMSU employee, letting people know about this. She's one of our communications folks. So again, I'm just very blessed to work with these folks every day. But again, I'd like to thank our speakers. Let's give them one last round of applause. Finally, I do, again, want to add my thanks to our state legislators for the work that you do every day and on behalf of New Mexicans and New Mexico families, and also the agencies that then implement what happens in policy. Thank you again for being here today. If you do have any follow-up comments or questions, Charlotte's card is in your packet, and just please let her know if you have any questions at all. Thank you. Thank you.